什么你
听说的。
Okay, this is an oral history with Paul Wilkes on the 29th of October 2002 in Philadelphia, PA, with David Brock and Arthur Demrich asking the question.
If we could, we'd like to start at the beginning and to ask you a little bit about your family background and your youth.
All right.
You could tell us.
I grew up in Springfield, Massachusetts. My father was an accountant or a financial officer of a paper company. My mother was a teacher. She taught shorthand and typewriting in the local high school. And I went to Springfield Technical High School. Springfield was unusual in that it had four high schools right within a stone's throw of each other: technical, commercial, classical, and a cathedral. And I went to Springfield Tech. I was always aiming toward Harvard because my father said he paid my way to Harvard if I made it. So anyway, but this was an unusual situation because everybody who was going to Harvard from Springfield went to classical high school, and I had to go across the street and take Latin in order to get the background. But I did get accepted, and I arrived at Harvard in 1941, just before Pearl Harbor. And I started out majoring in engineering, which is I guess you can't do it anymore at Harvard. In fact, they kind of discouraged it in those days. But to me, it was a perfect education because I was interested in technical things, but I also wanted the fine arts background that I got there. And I think the best course I ever took was English A, which I had to write a theme a day and that sort of thing, and it really taught me how to write, and it's probably one of the most useful courses that I took while I was there. I was deferred because I was majoring in engineering. At that time, even though I tried to enlist, the military said, keep on with your engineering course because we need engineers. Mm-hmm. And in my junior year, I had an operation which took a piece out of my chest, which when I graduated, it made me 4F anyway. So that, for that reason, I had no military experience. During the war, my father was an ordnance officer operating out of the Springfield Ordnance District, which covered all of New England. And he used to talk about this little optical company down in Glenbrook, Connecticut, that was turning out optics for gun sights and tank sights and that sort of thing at twice the quality and half the cost of any of the other optical companies around. And when I got to be a senior, Dad mentioned Dick Perkin was a friend of his, and Dick said, why don't you have Paul come down and talk to me? And at that time, I was being interviewed by, I remember, two other companies, General Electric and Carrier. And I was very much leaning toward Carrier because they were just starting off in air conditioning and that sort of thing. But I remember taking the train from Boston down to Stamford, going along the shore, and I'd always loved the water, and I had spent my summers in Newport, Rhode Island, so I was very close to sailing and that sort of thing, and I got more and more intrigued by Perkin Elmer as I got closer. But I went out, had lunch with Dick, and he showed me the plant and that sort of thing, and I decided that that's where I wanted to get a start. He talked to me about this new technology, infrared. He didn't know much about it, but he said, we're working with cyanamid, and it looks like something that's very important, and maybe you'd like to get involved. So,
if I could take you back a little
sure.
bit, how long had the family been in Springfield, Mass?
Oh, my father came from Newport, Rhode Island. My mother came from New Hampshire, and I guess he came to work for Milton Bradley in Springfield, the toy manufacturer. And my mother arrived there, she went to Smith, and I guess she got a job teaching in Springfield High School, and that's where they met. And so They spent their married life in Springfield, mm-hmm. so that's how we were there.
And
yeah, go ahead.
If you think back to high school, I mean, were you already interested in chemistry at all, engineering,
well, I did
tinkering?
I did very well in chemistry. I think I was more interested in physics. And, mm-hmm. and in fact, when I went to Harvard, I initially started to major in physics. And I decided it was a little too not down to earth enough. And so I switched over to engineering, mm-hmm. which was a much more practical kind of a thing to do. I had an interesting experience. When I was a junior, I had one of these envelopes, postcards in my mailbox saying that Dean so-and-so would see you at 2 o'clock next Thursday afternoon. And I wondered, what the heck have I done wrong, you know? I went into the see Dean Buck, I guess it was, and he had this record in front of me, and he said, Wilkes, he said, you had a perfect score in chemistry. He said, why aren't you majoring in chemistry? Here I am, a junior. And I said, well, I just liked engineering better. Well, he said, I can't understand why you're not majoring in chemistry. And that was the end of the interview. But anyway, Dick Perkin convinced me that Perkin Elmer was a place to come. And I learned this later on. He could talk anybody into working for him. He used to mm-hmm. come around to us and say, who do we need over here? And we'd say, so-and-so, and he'd disappear, and 3 or 4 months later, he'd say, he's coming next week, you know, that sort of thing. So, but I arrived in July of 1944. I was class of 45 at Harvard, but during the war, I went through in 3 years. And John White and I joined the company on the same day. He came from, it was SL Research in those days. And my first job was to go down to the machine shop, which was in downtown Stamford, and assemble the first infrared spectrometers that Perkin Elmer was working on, Model 12. And I put together, I guess, the first 50-odd instruments that they produced. I remember Dick Perkin saying to me, he thought there was maybe a market for 25 instruments, and they had their first initial production run was 25 instruments. And when we got halfway through, we had a backlog of 65. So anyway, and so that was my first job, assembling the instrument. And
who showed you how to do it? Was there a schematic you followed?
There was a chap named Kurt Opperman, who was a mechanical genius, who was. He supervised the machine shop, but the machine shop was separated from the optical shop, and that's where I was downtown in Stamford. Then later on, after I assembled the instrument, I would take it up to the plant in Glenbrook and out in the optical shop and put the optics in and do the final alignment and that sort of thing. And then it got shipped out from there. And I remember very clearly that we used to work Saturday mornings in those days, and two or three Saturday mornings, Dick Perkin would come in, and I'd be putting an instrument together. Is it ready to go? He'd say, and I said, yeah. And the two of us would go out to the shipping department, put it in crates, and put it in the panel track, and take it down to the Railway Express Agency, and Dick would say, well, that's next week's payroll. This was right at the end of the war, when all of the government contracts for optics were being reduced and canceled and that sort of thing. So the infrared instrument was what kept the company going for a few months. Perkin Elmer also had he formed a relationship with a group on Long Island that developed telephoto lenses. And they did the optical design, and the lenses were polished in the optical shop at Perkin Elmer, and the final assembly took place there. And that was the other division of Perkin Elmer. It was the telephoto lenses and this beginning instrument division, which was the Model 12. Hmm. And both groups grew very well and were quite separated in the marketing, and the optical division worked mostly for the government, and the instrument division worked mostly for industry, so they were quite separated. After I'd been there for about maybe 3 years, I said to Dick one day, you know, we've been running the same advertisement for the last 2 years, and analytical chemistry, I guess it was. And he said, well, that's right. He said, I'm hiring a new advertising agency, and I'd like to have you go down and talk with them. So I went to New York, and I met Fred Whitner, who was the new advertising agency. And from then on, I was in charge of advertising at Perkinelmer. And I had hired a guy to take my place in assembling the Model 12. And that's the fellow that's in the picture with Dick Perkin, Jack O'Connell. And he took over the assembly of the instrument. And I moved into the office and began to do sales work. And that led into the advertising. And for many years, I was in charge of Perkinelmer advertising until I left the company. And I had built up a group that had public relations and market research and advertising associated with it. And Whitner was a big advocate of house organs. And he talked us into putting out the Perkinelmer Instrument News. And for the first several years, I wrote every bit of it. And we published it quarterly, and we did a lot of work getting applications, studies, and that sort of thing. And I've left you a collection of them, but it was quite an undertaking, and I finally had a couple of guys helping me and so forth. So,
can I interrupt to ask a couple of questions?
Sure.
And then it goes back with a number of things that I'm interested in. One was, it seems that, I was interested in your decision to go to the technical high school.
Mm-hmm.
Was that because of your sort of proclivities in your youth toward technical and things of that nature?
I had a Model A Roadster, which I loved. I took it apart and did all the rings and dials and that sort of thing. And I liked working with my hands.
Mm.
And I enjoyed the technical side of things, how do things work and that sort of thing. And that led me into the technical high school rather than the classical high school, which was all arts and that sort of thing. So that was the reason.
And when you went to, during your time at Harvard studying engineering, did you take a distribution of the different types of engineering,
yes,
or was it mostly mechanical?
Well, it was mostly mechanical, but the one course that I took that really helped me later on, and I had no reason to believe it was going to, was a course in crystallography.
Huh.
And it was the only course I ever got an A in, but it was a study of crystal structure and things like that. And when I got into infrared, well, we were looking at molecules, and some of that really helped me in understanding what was going on. And that's the other one was a course in English, which I really thoroughly enjoyed. But that was the reason. I was always interested in doing things with my hands and trying to figure out what made things work, and that led me into engineering.
Did you have any professors that come to mind who encouraged you to pursue a technical career? Or did you have any mentor figures?
Not really. I had good professors, but I don't remember being particularly close to any of them. The one course I didn't take that I wish I had was a course in organic chemistry.
Mm.
I took a course in inorganic chemistry, but organic chemistry would have really helped me later on, because my whole career has been involved with organic chemistry since. So I remember I had another course that was very interesting, a Professor von Mises, who was a course in aerodynamics. And I'm not sure that really helped me later on, but it was fascinating to learn how a plane got off the ground and that sort of thing. You know, that was another course that I remember very well. So,
well, then just to fill in a couple.
Sure.
You spoke about Dick Perkins' ability to sort of charm anyone he wanted to into joining the firm. Could you tell us, give us your impressions of him, of Richard Perkins, and his role during in 44, let's say, when you joined, his activities in the company, that sort of thing?
I got to know him very well because he was a sailor. He had a starboat, and I was his crew. So every Saturday and Sunday, I went out with Dick. Dick was a kind of person who everybody liked. He had a wonderful personality, but he was a very poor administrator. And what he tended to do was to hire a person and put him in the company and let him find his own way in the company.
Mm.
And this caused a lot of dissension a little bit among the people that he brought in. Both Max Liston and John White had no use for Van Zandt Williams. Now, Van Williams was a associate of Bowling Barnes at Cyanamid. And Van is another person that Dick decided should join the company. And Cyanamid was contracting their instrument development activity at this stage, and both Barnes and Williams left. Barnes set up his own company. And I remember Dick Perkins telling me, go over and talk to Van. I knew Van from working with Cyanamid, because we were working together and developing the instruments. And I remember Van saying to me, what am I going to do? You know, he wants me to come to work for him. And I said, I don't know. I guess he wants you to be director of sales or something like that, of engineering. But he never made absolutely clear what Van's responsibility was going to be. And both John White and Max Liston, who had come to the company a couple of years before Van came, were both thinking they ought to get the head engineering job, and neither of them did. And I remember very clearly the day that we finished the Model 21, both John White and Max Liston went into Van and resigned. They finished their job and they decided they didn't want to stay with the company. The job stayed on a little bit longer because when the Model 21 was completed, well, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but the Model 21 got started because of Norman Wright at Dow, who had created this double beam instrument with his group there. And Van and John went out to Midland to look at it and came back and decided this was the future of infrared, this double beam system. It got around a lot of problems that the single beam instrument had. And so they immediately started this program with White, Liston, and later on Vinnie Coates to do the development work. When the instrument was completed, the first one, they actually drove it to New York, put it on a lower bunk in a sleeper car, and took it to Detroit. There was an Optical Society meeting in Detroit, and practically hand-carried it into the meeting and showed it. I remember this. But then when they came back, both John and Max decided to leave the company. But by that time, infrared had become really the major aspect. And it was, Perkin-Elmer had gone into electrophoresis as another technology, and they made a flame photometer, which was the precursor of the atomic absorption instrument, and that was quite a good instrument, and I had some time teaching people how to assemble that and that sort of thing, but I basically stayed in the infrared side.
Help me with the sequence at Perkin-Elmer. You arrive and are assembling the Model 12, then you're heading up advertising and writing the House Journal.
Well, actually, I moved out of assembly and hired Jack O'Connell to take over my job mm-hmm. and taught him what to do. And then I went into basically into sales.
Okay.
And Vince Coates and I both were Perkinheimer salesmen, and he and I covered the United States. I had Canada and the East Coast, I guess, and he had the central part of the company, and I had the West Coast. And between the two of us, we split the country up pretty much. But Dan Sam Williams' idea of selling was, you don't go call on the customer. If they're interested in buying one of your instruments, they come and visit you, you know. So. But,
so you didn't do that much traveling?
I did a fair amount. Mm-hmm. I remember I used to take a sleeper out of Stamford, and you could get a train to Montreal, right up the Connecticut River, you know, up into mm-hmm. Montreal, and I would get out at 8 o'clock at night, and I'd be in Montreal at 7 the next morning, and I'd go out to the oil refineries in Montreal East, you know, and I got to know Canada very well. And I also traveled down into New Jersey, which was a very good area for our instrumentation, and down in Maryland and in that area.
So you weren't selling this to academics?
No, this was primarily to industrial companies. Now, we had good sales to universities like Minnesota and MIT and that sort of thing, but the real business at this stage was to the DuPonts and Cyanamids. And DuPont was probably my closest associate as far as a customer is concerned. I spent a lot of time down there, and later on I'll go into some of the results that came from the DuPont relationship. But DuPont and Perkinheimer were very close together, and so I spent a lot of time in Wilmington.
Was it in 45 that you started to get into sales?
Well, it was probably around 1952 in that area.
Okay.
And it was the Model 21, I think, came out in 52, and that was our big product. The Model 12 was sort of in the background by that time. So the 21 was a,
right.
I had a very interesting meeting with names, you know, who's the guy who worked for the Department of Agriculture and was, who started Near Infrared.
Kay?
No. He's retired, but he's still quite active.
Mm.
His name will come to me.
Okay.
Well, I'll come back to that. But anyway, I was doing selling as well as writing copy for Instrument News and that sort of thing. About, I guess, in the mid-50s, I had an invitation to go to DuPont to meet with a group there that were good friends of mine, and I remember they took me out to lunch at the DuPont Country Club, and they said, where we're sitting is going to be the new experimental station. Over there is a new golf course. We have to build a golf course before we tear up this one. But they said, we're going to design the experimental station so that it has analytical alcoves in all the buildings. And we want to put an infrared spectrometer in each of these alcoves, but they said the Model 21 is too big and too expensive, and the Model 12 is not versatile enough. It's not the right instrument. We need a simpler instrument to put in these alcoves. And I remember sitting on the train coming back, thinking about it, and thinking that we could build that simple instrument that DuPont wanted, simply by taking a lot of the controls and the variability aspects of the Model 21 and making it smaller and that sort of thing. And I came back and I sat down with Dick Perkin and said, here's a real opportunity. The world needs this instrument. And his attitude was, you're going to kill the golden goose, because the Model 21 is our mainstay as a product in the company, and if we bring out something to compete with it that's far less expensive, we're going to be in big trouble. Well, it took me 2 years to finally convince the company that that this instrument was needed. And what really got it going was we heard that John White had hired out as a consultant with Beckman, and they were developing their IR-5, which was going to be a low-cost chemist instrument. So anyway, we finally got the Model 137 out, and that became the basis for the PerkinElmer infrared product line from then until the mid-80s, because until they came out with their FDIR instrument, the Model 137 was expanded and had many, went from prism to gratings, and it went through a whole series of improvements, and it really was a basic product line for PE. So about this time I began to get a little bit itchy. The company had a hierarchy. There were Ben Williams and the head of engineering and the head of production and the chief financial guy, and they were the managing committee of the company, and I was down at the next level, and it bothered me because I never could get into the Monday morning meetings and that sort of thing. And I began to think that maybe I could come up with a product line that could create a new division within PerkinElmer, and that would give me an opportunity to build something myself, you know, within the company. This is all going to be within the company. And this was about the time when television was just getting started. And one of the PerkinElmer optical engineers had developed a zoom lens. And it was a big bulky thing, but it worked very well. It was a way you could zoom in on a football game, you know, and that sort of thing. And also, I began to study the television industry a little bit and discovered that the format of the lenses that they were using, because of the image orthicon tube they were using in those days, was a little bit larger than the standard 35 millimeter camera. And to me, this was a wonderful opportunity for PerkinElmer to get into a totally new field. They had the optical designers, they had the optical polishers, and they had this wonderful zoom lens, which was really needed by the industry. So I found out that RCA down in Camden, New Jersey, was the leaders at this time in cameras and that sort of thing for the television industry. And I arranged a meeting down there and talked Dick Perkin into going down with me to Camden and visiting RCA, and I was promoting the ability of PerkinElmer to build optics for the television industry and trying to form a relationship between RCA and PerkinElmer. And in the car coming back, Dick Perkin was quiet for a long time. I remember going up the Jersey Turnpike, and he finally looked at me and he said, "Do you realize that most of those people that we were talking to were Jewish?" And I said, "I don't know, Dick." He said, "I don't really want to do business with that kind of an organization." That was the end of this project as far as PerkinElmer is concerned. Mm-hmm. They never went any further. I think they could have done a wonderful job. And this turned me off, because here was a thing I thought I could develop within PerkinElmer, and I couldn't get anywhere. So within a year, I decided I would go off and do something, and PerkinElmer had bought a company in New Jersey, Warren Electronics, which was an ultraviolet company. He had done some work in ultraviolet, and PerkinElmer had never really been involved with the UV, although we built a modification of the Model 12 for SO based on UV. I want to go back a little bit too, because about this time I got to know Howard Carey quite well, because we met him at shows, and you know, he was always in around, and I had dinner with him a couple of times in California. Very nice guy, really thoroughly liked him. And he came to me one time and said, "You know, what would be the possibility of maybe getting together with PerkinElmer?" So I went back and I talked with Dick Perkin, and to me this was a wonderful combination. That Kerry would bring the ultraviolet into the company, and they had a West Coast operation, and Perk and Elmer could do with a West Coast operation. And Dick was quite interested, too. And I probably made three trips out to Pasadena to talk with Howard and try to put things together. And it looked like a very good possibility. However, it didn't happen. And the reason it didn't happen was Van Zandt Bunyan. It didn't happen because Van Williams at that time was really very ambitious, and he wanted to be executive vice president and all that sort of thing. And it turned out that Howard Carey's salary was about $10,000 a year more than Van Williams, and he couldn't see having Carey come into the company and take his place. And Van had no use really for the ultraviolet region. And I remember he put on a talk to a group of publicists when we were introducing a new instrument or something like that. And somebody, one of the guys from the press, asked Van, why isn't Perkin Elmer involved with the ultraviolet? And Van said, here's why. He said, here's the ultraviolet region of the spectrum, and here's the infrared region. And he said, there's so much more information in the infrared region than there is in the UV. And of course, this is in the days when we were looking at wavelength versus frequency. So the UV wavelength region is this big, and the infrared wavelength region is this big. But if you look in frequency the way we do today, it's reversed. But anyway, this was his point. He said, and he was right, there is really much more information to be gained from the mid-infrared than there was from UV, and that's why he felt Perkin Elmer should concentrate there. One other thing that we worked on, and I think I had a lot to do with it, was to try to develop online infrared instruments. Mm-hmm. We had a program to develop an online gas analyzer and a liquid analyzer that could be plugged into the side of a chemical process. And I remember the first installation we made was in a chemical plant in New Orleans, a cyanamid plant. And the thing that we learned from it was that the thing that we thought we were going to use to measure to control the process turned out to be the wrong chemical. But this is one of the things you learn when you get into process control. What is it that really controls the process? Mm. You know? Well, Dick had no interest in process. He strictly wanted to stay in the laboratory, and we never really got very far with the process business. The other thing that came along about this time was chromatography. I was still with Perkin Elmer when gas chromatography appeared. And this I remember very clearly. I took a trip to the Texas oil fields because we were beginning to sell infrared instruments to the operators in the Texas oil fields, and what they were trying to do is to characterize the petroleum that was coming out of the ground. And they were using a Model 12 instrument to do this, and it did work. It took time and that sort of thing. Came back to St. Louis to give a paper at the American Petroleum Institute, and a friend of mine from Baird was doing the same sort of thing I was, and both of us were giving kind of a joint paper there. And I met him in the airport, and in the taxi on the way back, he said, you know, Paul, we're wasting our time. And he said, our guys have just come back from England, and they've heard about this new technique to based on separation of chemicals, and you get each one individually, and you do your quantitative measurement much easier, and so forth. So I gave my paper, and then I came back to Norwalk, and I discovered that Harry Hausdorff had also heard the same paper. And we had a meeting, and we all got together and said, this is nothing but a bunch of plumbing. There's no optics in it. It's really a very simple instrument. And therefore, every instrument company in the country is going to come out with a GC instrument. We better do as fast as we can. And really, Perkin Elmer had a six-month program. They had this was in May or June, and by the next PitCon, we had our first GC instrument. Hmm. We called it a vapor fractometer because gas chromatography is a misnomer anyway. They're not dealing with gases, they're dealing with vapors, and it's not chromatography, it's a fractionator, you know, it breaks up a mixture into its components. But the name didn't stick. Everybody called it a GC. The other thing that I think I recognized at this stage was that GC and infrared really belong together, because you could separate a mixture into its components, but you couldn't identify them with a GC. But if you could take these separated components and put them through an absorption cell in an infrared instrument, you could get a spectrum of each component as it appeared. And I wrote an article which is in the Instrument News saying that GC and IR belong together. And I think this was the first recognition that these two technologies really work together very well. So
What was the detect? They were using a conductivity.
Yeah, a conductivity cell, right. And later on, I'll get into it in CIC, but we spent a lot of time in some of my other companies in building sampling equipment that would tie the two technologies together. In the early days, we used quarter-inch columns. And those are big slugs of sample that came through, you know. So we could take a gas cell. We conceived of a light pipe gas cell. This was first done at GAC. I'm not GAC, CIC, Connecticut Instrument Company. But we could have a long light pipe gas cell, and as the fraction came out of the column, it would fill the cell, and we speeded up the spectrometer so we could get a spectrum in maybe 2 minutes or something like that, and we could pretty well characterize these components as they came out of the chromatogram. In fact, we even tried to convince the GC people they should have a start-stop chromatograph. You know, when one beat comes out, stop the process for a minute, and we get a spectrum of it, and that sort of thing. But that was after I left Bergen-Elmer. But about this time, as I said, Bergen-Elmer had purchased a company called Warren Electronics Scientific, I guess it was. Chuck Warren was the president of it. And he was an entrepreneur, and he wasn't very comfortable at Bergen-Elmer either. And the two of us did a lot of talking. We finally decided we would leave and try to set up a company on our own. And we searched around for something to hang our business on, and we thought of instruments and that sort of thing. But about this time, we both got interested in ultrasonic machining, because we were interested in glass and forming glass and that sort of thing. And we decided to get an ultrasonic machine and then offer the services of machining glass for various applications. So we set up a shop about half a mile north of Bergen-Elmer on Route 7, and we got a contract making sidewinder dampers, they call them. These were glass discs that had in them two grooves and mercury, a little bit of mercury in each of the grooves, and then they melted a cover on top of it. Mm-hmm. This was a vibration damper. It inside the sidewinder missile, the mercury would move to counteract vibration and that sort of thing. Now, we made several thousand of these under contract with a company in New Jersey. And about this time, I got a letter from a very close friend of mine, Norman Jones, whom you probably should interview if you haven't interviewed him. He is a Canadian infrared guy. I think he's retired, but he was working for the National Research Council in Canada at that time. And he sent me a paper, which is in the archives that I've given you, and all he wrote across of it was best wishes from Norman Jones. And what it was a description of how to make an infrared absorption cell by means of ultrasonic machining, called a cavity cell. And I'm always interested in trying to get the costs down and things, make them less expensive and more widely used and that sort of thing. And this fascinated me, and we spent a lot. We had the equipment. We had the ultrasonic machine. And Chuck and I spent a lot of time figuring out how to put a cavity in a piece of rock salt And we learned how to do this, and it became quite a product. And I remember taking it to PitCon and in my pocket and showing it to my friends there. Well, one thing led to another. We had to learn how to polish rock salt to make the cavity cells, and then we discovered that we could also grind and polish windows for infrared spectrometers, and very quickly it occurred to me that there was a market for a company that did nothing but accessories, and because the big companies were concerned in making instruments, and that was what they're good at, and I've spent a lot of time putting together seal cells and that sort of thing at PerkinElmer and so forth. So from the cavity cell, it led us into a whole line of infrared accessories. Mm-hmm. And we developed at CIC accessories that are still being used today. Everybody uses cells where you screw the top on and two windows and spacers and that sort of thing. Well, this was all created at CIC. And I remember Van Williams coming up one day saying, "You'd like to come and visit me," and I showed him our shop. He was just down the street from us. He said, "You know what, Paul? You're really doing us a favor because you're creating accessories that help sell our instruments." And he said, "We can't mess around with $100 items. You know, we're selling $10,000 instruments, and that's the way our business is." So he was very supportive of us, and we did a lot of work with PerkinElmer and PerkinElmer customers and that sort of thing. And so a company that started off to do ultrasonic machining turned into an infrared accessory company.
Can I ask you a few questions more about the sort of business side? When you left PerkinElmer, was there, who funded you? Did you have?
Very interesting question. Charles Elmer owned a third of the company. Mm-hmm. Dick Perkin owned two-thirds. When he died, Charlie Elmer, he left his one-third interest to be resold to the PerkinElmer employees. So all of us who were employees at that time got a certain number of shares of stock based on our salary at that time. And I remember my wife being very upset because I was putting $25 a week into buying PerkinElmer stock when my total salary was like $60 a week. You know, but that gave me a kitty because by the time I left the company, the stock had really appreciated a great deal. So that gave me enough resources to get GAC started, CIC started. And Chuck Warren also had gotten some money when he sold his company. So between the two of us, I don't know, we probably each put in $5,000 a piece to start the company. This is in 1962 or something like that when we started the company. No, it was 57. I left PerkinElmer in 57. So that's where my basic initial capitalization came from.
And your initial customers were this in the cavity cell.
Yeah, that was a company in New Jersey,
which was essentially defense R&D.
We didn't stick with the ultrasonic machining, except for making cavity cells, very long. It turned out to be much more difficult than we had anticipated. We tried to make little pointers and lots of stuff that didn't really work out very well. But as soon as we got going in the infrared accessory field, then the company began to move.
And in terms of finding customers and reaching them, how important was PitCon? I mean, you mentioned...
Well, let me go back to PitCon. Yeah. I have some things to say about PitCon. I was responsible for the PerkinElmer booths from the very beginning. Now, PerkinElmer didn't go to the first PitCon because we had an ISA show in Houston. I remember they conflicted with it. But the second one, PerkinElmer went, and then from then on it was there, and I was responsible all the time I was with PerkinElmer for putting on the PitCon booth. When I left PerkinElmer, maybe a year after I left, we'd gotten into the infrared accessory business, so I was back to PitCon with CIC. CIC was purchased by Barnes Engineering, and they stayed on at PitCon. Later on, Don Sting bought the product line from Barnes Engineering and set up Spectratech. And they are still at FitCon in very one shape or another. Then later on, I set up Wilk Scientific, and it immediately went to FitCon, and I set up, and it stayed there because when Foxborough bought Wilk Scientific, it continued to exhibit. And then GAC, we did the same thing, and now Wilkes is there. It really bugs me that the people in the Pittsburgh conference have never recognized Paul Wilkes. And I have done so much for that. I've written articles, I've written, this is probably, you should turn off the machines.
But we'll edit it out afterwards.
Yeah, they, you know, at least five different companies I've started, and they're there, and year after year, and they're still there now and under different names and that sort of thing. And somehow I've never gotten any kind of recognition. I've never gotten invited to their special Wednesday night dinner, you know, this sort of thing, which I wouldn't go to now if they invited me. But anyway, it just bothers me. End of FitCon, I'll come back to GAC, yeah. To CIC. CIC did very well when we got into the accessory business, and I had another one of these experiences. You know, you learn so much at shows. Every time I go to a show, I learn something about something new. It's not talking to customers so much as it is hearing about new technologies or whatever. And we had an exhibit in New York City, I'm trying to think of when this was, about 1962, I guess. Abe Savitsky, or rather, a fellow named Donald Johnson from DuPont came into our booth there, and he said, "Hey, Paul," he said, "there's a new technology that you ought to look at called attenuated total reflection." He said, "It was developed by a guy at Shell in Holland." And he said, "Our people are very excited about it." And he said, "You're in infrared accessories. It opens up a whole new way of sampling." And Abe Savitsky came in a little later and said, "We just heard about this too." And he said, and I gave him a ride back to Norwalk, and all the way back he was talking about this technology. Well, we looked into it, and we decided we're going to do something with it. And we went ahead and designed an attachment that fitted into a spectrometer that had a prism made out of silver chloride. I guess we decided it was the best material. And you could clamp a sample on the back, and you could put it in the instrument and get a spectrum. And this was the first commercial application of ATR. And today, it's probably the most widely used sampling method there is, and this little instrument is based on ATR. And at that time, Chuck Warren and I had decided we didn't really like working together. He was, you know, we were friendly and that sort of thing, but he wanted to go off into UV and I wanted to go into infrared, and Bowling Barnes had been after me for a year to talk to him, and I finally went and talked to him and decided to sell the company to Bowling Barnes. And you remember these things that happened. We were in the process of signing the papers, and all the lawyers are around like this, you know, and Barnes said, "Well, now we want a guarantee from you that all of the, you've disclosed all the bills and liabilities and everything." And I said, "Well, sure we have, but I don't want to sign anything that, you know." And my lawyer said to me, "I want to talk to you." And he took me out in the hall and he said, "Is there anything under the rug that you haven't disclosed?" I said, "No." He said, "What are you worried about?" He said, "I'll tell you what we do." He said, "You ask for something in return. They want you to sign an agreement that for 2 years you'll be liable for anything that comes up. What would you like to get?" Well, I said, "They're after me to give them a 3-year no-compete contract. Maybe we could shorten that to a year." So we go back in, and my lawyer said, "Wilkes will sign this, providing you reduce the no-compete from 3 years to 2 years." No question, they were glad to do this. Well, I stayed with Barnes for just about a year in a I guess I didn't fit into the company politics, you know, the way it always happens. So I left, and about this time I got involved with Jim Herrick. Jim was very fascinated by internal reflection spectroscopy. He was the number two guy after Farnforth that really did all the calculations on why it worked and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And he wrote this wonderful book, which we still use today. And he invited me up to Phillips Laboratory, which was close to us in Tarrytown, New York, and he showed me the multiple ATR, where you do have multiple reflections instead of a single reflection, which is what we're using at CIC. Well, we developed an attachment with a multiple reflection ATR, and this was our first product at Wilk Scientific. And it took us almost a year to get it out, and Barnes kept telling me, you're competing, and we even changed the name. We called it frustrated multiple internal reflection instead of attenuated total reflection, and we sort of skirted around. But anyway, that became the first product of Wilk Scientific Corporation, which was based on ATR. At both companies, we did a lot of work on GCIR products too. At Wilk Scientific, I took the Perkin-Elmer 137 and took off the source optics and put a light pipe between the source and the entrance slits so that we could pump energy from a GC through it. And that was a spectrometer that was dedicated to doing GCIR work. And about that time, Myron Block got in touch with me, and he said wanted me to come down to Maryland, where they were putting together their first FTIR instruments. And they were convinced that the FTIR and GC belonged together because FTIR was so fast. Mm-hmm. You know, they could take very rapid scans, and they could get these peaks as they came out of the chromatograph. And we taught them how to make light pipes to go with his instrument. I discovered that we had to use rectangular ones with a slit instrument, but with an FTIR you can use circular light pipes, which are a lot easier to make and that sort of thing. But anyway, we really got the world started on using light pipes for various types of application in the infrared.
Now, by light pipe, you're talking about, you know, like a gas cell, right?
Yeah, it's just a gold-plated tube.
Right.
And they function because you don't need focusing optics or anything like that. The energy just bounces down the surface until it gets to the end, and then it comes out the same way it came in. I mean, if it's condensed going in, it expands coming out.
Right.
And it just means that you can get a long path and fill it with gas and measure very low concentrations and that sort of thing.
Okay.
We use them all the time today for various purposes, light pipes, but... Anyway, that's where it all started. Mm-hmm. So that I've gotten myself from CIC to Wilk's Scientific now, which we started in Norwalk, actually in the same building I'm in right now. We started our company there. It didn't have the front two-story on it, but it was. We rented space and gradually took it over.
In terms of the relationship with Barnes, I mean, was there a longer history to that, or was it simply walked into a meeting and he said, I want to buy your company?
No, he'd known me for quite a while, and he'd watched, I knew him at Cyanamen.
Oh.
And the reason he wanted to purchase our company was that Barnes Engineering was totally military oriented, and they were infrared. They made infrared detectors, bolometers, and that sort of thing. And he wanted to get a commercial business into the company. He thought he could balance the military. And that's why he was interested in CIC, because we were totally commercial. And it looked like a good fit as far as we were concerned. But what I learned when I got there was that the people who were running Barnes wanted no part of it. Business. They were so busy, and this is kind of typical, you know, companies that do business with the military, there's a way of doing business, and they don't understand the kind of going out on nitty-gritty commercial side, you know, and I just couldn't find a niche in Barnes that was comfortable. And so I only lasted for a year, and then I told Bolling, I think I'm going to go do it again. But he had the product line, and he finally ended up selling the product line that he bought from me to Don Sting. So that was the history of it. But I, as I said, I've known him for many years, and he's a great guy. I mean, you know, you go into his office, you spend half the morning there because he talked. He loved to talk. And anyway, so Wilk Scientific was the second company that I started, and we again went into infrared accessories, this time based on a little more complex instrumentation, and most of it, a lot of it was ATR devices of various sorts, and we developed horizontal ATR, which is what everybody uses today, but had a flat surface that you could put a sample on and that sort of thing, as opposed to a vertical surface like the early instruments. And
who were you selling to?
Again, the same basic, the industrial market primarily, because we were trying to give them practical equipment to solve problems. And we were trying to get beyond just making accessories, and I hired an infrared spectroscopist from England. He was, but he was educated at University of Minnesota, Tony Gilby. And he was very interested in applying infrared, and I went over and had dinner with him in England, and we got together, and I asked him if he'd like to come and work for us, and he did. And he brought to the company an ability to design optics, and he was a good mechanical designer. He was a heck of a good scientist, really. And Tony and I went out to a meeting in Anaheim, California. And it was a Pacific Coast spectroscopy meeting. And here was an instrument introduced by Beckman. And it was a rapid scan infrared spectrometer designed to look at GC fractions as they came out. We have to go back a little bit in history, because there was a big rivalry between Perkin-Elmer and Beckman. A fundamental difference between the two companies: Perkin-Elmer understood aspheric optics, and they had Halimogi, who could make off-axis parabolas. And that meant that they could use a very low F number in their optical design, like F25, which, and what that means is that the smaller the F number, the bigger the numerical aperture, the more energy you can pump through your optical system. And this is always a problem in infrared. It's always energy limited. You need to have, the more efficient optical system you have, the higher the signal to noise ratio, and the more you can analyze. And Beckman did not have this optical skill, and their instruments were like F10 instruments. And Perkin-Elmer always ran circles around Beckman for this reason, that they had like 100 times as much energy to work with as a typical Beckman instrument, and therefore they were that much more sensitive. Well, this persisted, and when Tony and I looked at this Beckman instrument that they had introduced as a rapid scan instrument, it had in it a circular variable filter. And this is a filter that has segments. As you scan across the segment, the wavelength that is transmitted by that segment changes. So you could rotate this filter in a beam and create a rather crude infrared spectrum. And they were using this filter to look at effluence from a chromatograph. But it was an F10 system. It was had a very bad signal to noise ratio, and Beckman was not happy with it, and they discontinued it. But I was fascinated, because to me, here's a way of making a poor man's infrared spectrometer. You want to change?
No, we're okay.
Yeah, well, might as well. Yeah.
to me, it said we could build a little package like this, that we could do, we could select any wavelength we wanted, make measurements on different materials and that sort of thing, with a way of making a very inexpensive but very versatile little infrared analyzer. And I learned that the filter was manufactured by a company in the West Coast called Optical Coating Laboratories, OCLI. The president was Ralph Ilsley. And I got back to Norwalk, and I called up OCLI, and I said, I'm interested in your circular variable filter. Is there somebody there who could talk to me about it? Oh, yes, that's our president, Ralph Ilsley. This is his pet project. So Ralph gets on the telephone, and I told him what I thought about it, he said, well, you couldn't have hit me at a better time because Beckman has backed out of the project. They don't think they can make any use of it, and we've got to figure out something. He said, come out and visit. So I flew out to San Francisco, and as I arrived at the airport, I'm paged, and I pick up the phone, and Mr. Ilsley is waiting for you in the commercial aviation section. Well, he had his own plane, and he'd flown down, and I went over there, and he flew me up to Santa Rosa, which is 100 miles or so north of San Francisco, to their plant. And we had a great visit, and I finally ended up by saying that we would buy up all of the Beckman filters that they made. We buy them from Beckman, and then he'd make more for us, and we changed the design a little bit. And so I came back, and Tony and I looked at it and decided, what are we going to do with this filter? Well, this was right at the time when the automobile or the emissions people were looking for emissions analyzers, gasoline engines, you know, NH and NOXs and carbon monoxide and that sort of thing, which you could do very nicely by infrared because they all have characteristic bands. So Tony developed a long path gas cell that was somewhat similar to the White cell. John White had developed one several years ago while he was at PerkinElmer, but it had some faults. It was very difficult to change the path length in the White cell. But Tony had a very clever design where you could rotate a mirror and convert it from a meter path length up to 20 meters. We could get through it, and we developed. And our object was to sell it to the emissions people in New Jersey and wherever they were setting up emission centers. By the time the instrument came out, we were behind this other people had come along with gas analyzers and they captured the market and so forth. However, the OSHA had just come into existence at that stage, and the world was very concerned about toxic vapors in the workspace, the atmosphere. And all of a sudden our instrument was just the one that was needed. And we walked into this market without really realizing it. The one that we headed out originally to try to sell the instrument to was gone, but this one, and that's the instrument that you have here. It's a big kludgy instrument, but probably at least 10,000 of those instruments are sold, and they're still being used today. There's nothing that has really taken their place, although there is going to be one that will. But anyway, that led Wilkes Scientific into a totally different business. Instead of being an accessory manufacturer, we became an instrument company. And I got interested in this stage in interference filters, because there are so many things you can do with them. They give you a narrow band pass, and my interest always has been to find practical applications for infrared. And what you learn is that an FBIR or a PRISM instrument will develop an application, and they'll pick out an absorption band, and if we measure that absorption band, we can control this process. Well, you don't need an infrared spectrometer to do that. All you need is a filter instrument, a filtrometer, which is what we started making at Wilkes Scientific. And we developed two instruments. One was a gas analyzer. The other was an infrared probe, where we had an optical element we could stick into a beaker and analyze what was in the beaker. Well, for various reasons, that never got to be very successful, but the gas analyzer was tremendously successful. And I have to tell you a little Perkin Elmer Beckman story at this stage. We had at Wilkes Scientific this Model 9 ATR attachment, and I loaned one to Bob Hanna in the application laboratory at Perkin Elmer. Three months later, I went to a spectroscopy meeting in Chicago, and one of my friends said, "Hey, you got to go in the Perkin Elmer booth." I go into the Perkin Elmer booth, and here's a carbon copy of this instrument with Perkin Elmer label on it. Same mirrors, everything. And I got upset at this. Now, when I got back to Norwalk, I called up Chester Nimitz, who was the president, junior, who was president of Perkin Elmer, and I said, "Chester, I'd like to come up and visit you." "Oh, sure, Paul, anytime." So I remember one snowy afternoon, I drove up to Perkin Elmer, which is about 10 miles north of us. I took my instrument. I had purchased one of the Perkin Elmer instruments. I went over to his office, I sat him down on the table, and I said, "Chester, why did you copy this?" I said, "I loaned it to you so that we would be glad to make it for you, put it on your own label and that sort of thing." He looked at me, he said, "I'm going to build this company 20% a year." And he said, "You don't have a patent on that, do you?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I'm going to copy, steal, I'm going to build this company." And he said, "You've been patented anything you develop next time." Anyway, down the line, 3 or 4 years later, we had this 20-meter gas cell. And Beckman came to us and said, "Can you adapt this to fit into an infrared spectrometer?" We worked on it, and yes, we did. And there is a wonderful book that they put out on OSHA compliance testing using an infrared spectrometer and a 20-meter gas cell, which we made for them. Perkin Elmer came to us and said, "Can you put it in our Model 21? And he said, "Sure, we can do the optics and so forth." After we had been delivering them to Perkin Elmer for about 6 months, the Perkin Elmer purchasing agent called me up and he said, "Hey, Paul," he said, "how come you sell the same cell to Beckman for 90% of what you sell them to Perkin Elmer?" And I said, "This is the way we're getting back at you guys for copying our instrument." And literally, we charged Perkin Elmer 10% more offer for years. And I always remember that there's always a way to get back at somebody. So, but anyway, that cell led Wilkes Scientific into gas analysis, and we designed a lot of similar instruments that were portable, easy to carry around, dedicated instrument. Or if you wanted a versatile one, you got the Marin 1A, which is what you have downstairs here. And the company grew, and we were growing very rapidly. We were growing faster than we could generate cash to support our growth. And I remember we sold a 40% interest in the company to EG&G. And I made a deal with them that 2 years down the pike, if one or the other could offer to buy the remaining interest in the company. And if that happened, EG&G made an offer to buy the 60%, no, the 40, the 60% that we still own, we could buy back the 40% at the same price. And we had 6 months to raise the money to do it. Well, we did trigger the thing. We said to them, "We'd like to buy back the 40% interest. Make us an offer for the 60%. And I remember we had a big pool in the office when they had 30 days to come up with a price. And we were betting, you know, "What are they going to offer for us?" You know, this sort of thing. Well, it turned out they offered us half what anybody in the company had thought the company was worth. And we had 6 months to come up with our money to buy back EG&G. And we found a company that was International Nickel, which we hired a financial guy to try to find a partner. And he came in with International Nickel that was trying to expand into high-tech business. And they paid twice as much as EG&G had offered for the 40% interest in the company. So we bought back EG&G. Sold the 40% to International Nickel and had some working capital. But anyway, a few years later, we reached the point where we were still capital tight, and we couldn't go public in those days because this was in the mid-70s. The stock market was terrible. There was tremendous inflation. There was no market for new issues. And Bendix came after us, and they wanted to buy us to fit us in with one of their groups they had in West Virginia that was involved with infrared. And I almost sold the company to Bendix, but Foxborough heard that we were available. And I remember I was in Holland with my son. He was working in our English facility at that time. I met him in Amsterdam. We're sitting in a Holiday Inn, and I get a telephone call. And it was from the treasurer, or the vice president of Foxborough. And he said, Paul, he said, don't sell to Bendix. We really want you. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I turned off the Bendix deal. And what Fox, he had a very good idea. Foxborough was a company that made process instruments. Process control instruments, basically temperature, pressure, and flow. That's all they did. And his attitude was, we need these new technologies. We need infrared, we need gas chromatography, we need conductivity. Mm. And he went out and bought a conductivity company, an infrared company, which was us, and a GC company. And these are going to operate as satellites to the main company. You go on doing your own thing, but we'll use your technology to expand our process control application. Well, it worked fine until a guy named Chuck McKay was put in charge of these satellite companies, and his attitude was, he's going to build another Foxborough. He's going to bring them all in under one area and combine them, and that was the kiss of death as far as I was concerned, because I didn't want any part of being part of Foxborough. I was very happy to run my little segment of Foxborough down in Norwalk. Mm-hmm. So that led me out of Foxborough. But anyway.
If we can pause a little at Wilkes Scientific prior to the Foxborough deal. The customers, same thing as before?
Basically, yes. We were selling to the chemical processing industry. That's our big market.
Right. And in terms of OSHA and the sort of new market in the environmental area, how did you track that? How did you sort of see that market emerging?
Well, I think it sort of came to us in a sense that all of a sudden OSHA was concerned about workplaces. Mm-hmm. And I guess we recognized that we had the kind of instrument that could be. I remember going down to a pharmaceutical company, in New Jersey.
Merck?
No, it was a cyanamide subsidiary, which has since been merged with somebody else, but they wanted to measure ethylene chloride in the atmosphere, which was used for sterilizing and that sort of thing. I think that was the first time we ever tried using this instrument, and we discovered it worked very well. We could put it in a corridor and we could wave the wand around and figured out the worst place to stand to be in this corridor were these alcoves where they had desks and people sat there. Even though they had fans blowing out in the middle, the alcoves had high concentrations of the gas. Well, that's the kind of thing you learn from it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we began to realize that this was a very good potential market, and we advertised, we went to shows, and I went to a meeting in Washington. It wasn't vinyl chloride, it was ethylene chloride in there, but vinyl chloride. Do you remember there was a big scare about vinyl chloride? There was a group of men who worked in a vinyl chloride plant in Cincinnati, and they'd worked there for 10 years, and most of them got cancer. Well, that's what really ticked off OSHA, and they made big regulations about vinyl chloride. And I went to a meeting in Washington. And this was put on by the Department of Labor, and they were trying to establish limits for vinyl chloride in the atmosphere. And they knew I came from an instrument company, and they pointed to me out in the audience, and they asked me to stand up, and they said, you make an instrument that can measure ambient air. How low can you measure vinyl chloride in the atmosphere? And I thought, I don't know, we can probably get down to a part per million. That's the level. And immediately they set one part per million because it was feasible to measure that. Not because it made any sense, because these guys who are exposed to it were exposed to 10,000 parts per million day after day, you know.
Right, right.
But anyway, they established this ridiculous low. Well, we sold a lot of instruments to the myochloride field because we had the only instrument that would measure down to the OSHA limit, you know.
But, I mean, in a sense, OSHA didn't have the health and safety data, so they went to the measurement level.
Yeah. The typical reaction was, how low can you measure?
Right.
They still do this today, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Bugs
right.
made, like arsenic in water, for example, parts per billion. Well, you can stand a lot higher level of arsenic, but because we have techniques that will measure that low,
mm-hmm.
that's where they set the limit. Without any real scientific study, what's harmful and what isn't. But we made a lot of money on it, so I can't be upset, but it really bothered me that they made mm-hmm. decisions based on lack of scientific or medical history or whatever. So anyway.
Well, so this is happening,
the late 60s, right?
This was in the early 70s.
Okay.
Our instrument came out in 1971, the Myron analyzer.
Right.
Myron stands for Miniature Infrared Analyzer. That's the acronym.
Right.
And so it was in the 70s when this business, you know, the OSHA business expanded, and we expanded, and we ran out of capital because we expanded too fast, and that's what led us to sell out to Foxborough.
Mm-hmm. Did OSHA, in the same time period, like with the EPA, they're defining analytical methods, even saying, you know, so if you're going to analyze water, use a GCMS, you know, da 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 da. What was OSHA doing?
No. OSHA just wanted something to measure, you know, a piece of equipment to measure. Now, I've worked a lot lately with the EPA, and they're totally different. They define methods. This is the way you're going to make the measurement, you know. And at OSHA, the attitude was, here's the limit we set, and then you've got to find a piece of equipment that will measure that
mm-hmm.
limit. So.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that takes mm-hmm. me through Wilkes Scientific, which of all of my companies was probably my favorite one.
How many employees did you have?
We had, at that time, we had 220-odd employees. Now, the reason for this was that at that time, we couldn't farm out our manufacturing. We were not in our neighborhood or anywhere that the kind of optical shops that we needed to do infrared optics or electronic assembly or machine shops.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to have within Wilkes Scientific all the resources to build our product. Today it's totally different because especially in our part of Connecticut, Fairfield County, there are optical shops that do beautiful work on infrared optics, and there are machine shops, there are electronic assembly, circuit design people.
Mm-hmm.
My next company, GAC, got up to the same volume with 60 people instead of 120 people because we farmed out everything.
Yeah.
And so, but the Wilkes Scientific had a large number of employees for just this reason.
Hmm.
And how did you act as manager? I mean, were you focused on new product development? Are you focused on marketing and sales? Are you overseeing all of it?
Combined. My prime interest is to recognize an opportunity in the marketplace
mm-hmm.
that can use my technology. So I really concentrate on where can we apply infrared spectroscopy in the marketplace. And what's happened in infrared over the years is that other programs like the space program have developed new infrared detectors, new infrared materials have come out of other programs, and it lets us instrument people apply them
mm-hmm.
to what I call real world problems, you know, solving like OSHA or solving problems in chemical industry or whatever. And we're constantly able to make use of infrared in smaller and less expensive devices that are more sensitive. You know, this is
mm-hmm.
the way the world turns.
Yeah, yeah.
And Today we're getting the same kind of help from the computer industry. We get these little chips, you know. Mm-hmm. I've got a whole infrared spectrometer right here, you know, just in micro electronics in it. But anyway, that when Chuck McKay began to gather all these satellite companies together in Foxborough, again, I said, this is not me, you know, I don't want to be part of a big organization.
If I can, I mean, I guess I want to, let me try asking the same question a little differently. I mean, what was your management style at Wilkes? How would you characterize
it? Well, I think it was to try to have the best people I could get take responsibility for various aspects of the business. Like mm-hmm. Tony Gilby was our chief engineer, and I had a good production guy, and then had people who worked in the laboratory. I think I'm very weak in financial management because we're always way ahead of the resources we have to do what we want to do. But I tried to develop a team of people that we could have our Monday morning meetings and do our planning. But the company, the manufacturing side, pretty well work itself. And I spent really most of my time looking for new markets for our existing products, or looking for markets where we could develop a new product to fill that market. That's where I concentrated my efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the people that worked for me at Wilkes Scientific came along to General Analysis, and some of them are with me today. A couple of people, one of them was from Wilkes Scientific, another from GAC, and we're beginning to take on other people from companies that I've had who are still available in the area. So,
mm-hmm.
But I think you asked the question, I think my management skills are basically marketing and applying a technology to the marketplace,
yeah.
And that's the way
yeah.
I function. So anyway, we have one more company to go through.
Well, I was going to suggest, do we want to pause?
It's up to you. When I was at PerkinElmer, I was in charge of the first exhibit they ever put on, which was in Grand Central Palace, which was an exhibit hall right next to Grand Central Station in New York. It was a chemical industries exhibit, and I was all by myself setting up a booth there. We had a Model 12 with a big thing around it, and there was this rather stocky, tall, bald guy who was standing in the background, and he watched me. He kept coming back and watching me, and he finally came over to me after I got the booth all set up. He said, I'm Arnold Beckman, and he said, I know who you are. You're from PerkinElmer, and he said, we're building an infrared activity in the West Coast, and I'd like to have you consider coming out and joining us. And I thought about this for a while, and you know, this is like somebody from Yale approaching a Harvard man.
Yeah.
And I was very polite, and I said, no, I don't think I really want to do this. And I went back and I told Van that, and Van said, well, he said, they're trying to build their business, if you want to go ahead. If you want to live in California. And I said, no, I'm going to stay in Connecticut. But I was very pleased that this very nice gentleman knew who I was and said, well, and anyway, I was seen him a number of times after that. But okay, well, we're...
So you let drop an interesting comment about Foxborough,
uh-huh.
And prior to it, you said you were visiting with your son in Europe, in Amsterdam.
Yes.
So you had taken Wilkes Scientific international.
Yes, we had a facility in Milton Keynes, which was a growing area in England at that time, and he had gone through a divorce situation and that sort of thing, and he was looking for a job, and I hired him.
Yeah.
And he went over there, and he really helped set up that facility, because we did some manufacturing there. My interest in going to England was the British have a lot of good ideas, and you can often get some good, they're lousy at running a company, you know, building a marketing, that sort of thing, but they have good ideas, and I thought if we had a facility in England, it would help us. Besides, we had a lot of business there at the time, so we had quite a successful operation in Milton Keynes, and Don was working for me there.
Now, of course, environmental and health regulations were completely different. I mean, were you monitoring?
But they're very similar in England. Uh-huh. They had a very similar thing to OSHA, and we were doing final assembly on these Myron analyzers in England, because we could get inside the customs barrier by having partially assembled equipment, that sort of thing. And, mm-hmm. and we were doing a good business in England, also on the continent. So it made sense to have a facility there. We always had a good export business in all of my companies, and I used to travel a great deal to Europe selling accessories and instruments and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anyway,
Foxborough.
I left Foxborough, and I had an idea that there was so much interest in occupational environment monitoring that we could set up a company doing that service. And in fact, Don came with me too. He left Foxborough about the same time, and I talked him into setting up a facility to equip vans with mm-hmm. instrumentation. And I went to Foxborough and made a deal with them that I could buy analyzers, Myron analyzers from them. And we tried to build a business offering services in doing workspace monitoring. Well, this was about the time Ronald Reagan became president. And Reagan put the clamps on occupational health, and it killed the business. It was absolutely dead. Hmm. And it never took off the ground. But while I was with Foxborough, just before I left, I had gotten interested in a new type of internal reflection optical element, which was something that I came up with, which was to have a cylinder that we could reflect energy down through, and we could surround the cylinder with liquid and use it as a measuring tool. And I got interested in the beverage industry, that they needed to measure sugar in water. That's something we could do with this kind of an approach. And also carbon dioxide in water. And these are the two principal things that are measured when you're making Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola or whatever. And we actually started a program at Foxborough, and then when I left Foxborough, I forgot all about it while we were trying to do this occupational health thing. And then I went back and decided maybe there's a real potential here, because the beverage industry really needed something that would monitor the quality of their product. So we developed a process monitor based on circular internal reflection, which is a sensing tool. And Don did a lot of the design work on it, and I came up with some optical concepts that are quite different than what we ever had before. Very interesting sidelight was that when I was at Foxborough, I applied for a patent on circular internal reflection optical element. No, actually, I did this at Wilkes Scientific before we sold to Foxborough. And we didn't have any money at this stage, and the first stage of the patent, they came back, and as they always do, they knock everything down, you know, and they expect you to come back and fight for this. And we didn't have the resources, and Don, my son, was never happy about patents. He said they're a waste of time, people can copy them. So we just let it die. Well, a patent issued, and it issued covering a variable path length scheme that we put into the patent, but it didn't cover they wouldn't give us the basic concept of circular internal reflection. So when we started developing an instrument at GAC using circular internal reflection. I got this very nice letter from Foxborough saying, you're infringing on our patent. And I wrote back and I said, please read the patent carefully, because you will find that it doesn't cover circular internal reflection at all. didn't have enough money to pursue the patent, because I think we could have gotten a basic patent on it. And Jim Herrick said it won't work. He republished an article in Applied Spectroscopy saying, I can prove mathematically that the circular internal reflection rod won't function. So it did function, because it worked for us, and my approach has always been what I call empirical optics. My son is a fundamentalist. He has to lay everything, do all the ray tracing and that sort of thing. My idea is that you just throw some energy in at this side, and if it comes out on this side and you can get some reflection in between, it's going to work. And I don't quite know how the rays actually trace them way through it, but these things do work. And I've got one that I'll talk about later, which is the same kind of thing. But anyway, we decided to build a beverage analyzer, and it took us about more than 2 years to get one that really worked. We installed two or three at Pepsi plants, and they didn't function for various reasons. They coated, the crystals coated, and we had interference between CO2 and bricks and that sort of thing. And when we finally worked our way out of these problems, we went to Coca-Cola, and Pepsi had gotten rid of us by this time, and Coke accepted the product, and we eventually went back, and Pepsi did too. But in the next several years, maybe 5 years or so, we equipped most of the beverage lines in the world, the big ones. We probably put out close to 2,000 of these beverage analyzers, and I hit the age of 70, and my wife decided it was time for me to retire, and the company was going well. We're doing about $8 million in business, although it was in a somewhat of a slump because the beverage industry was down, and I had spent a lot of time trying to find other markets for the same basic instrument, and I decided that we should have somebody take over GAC, and I gave Don the opportunity. I'm not sure he really wanted the job, but anyway, I put him in charge, and it turned out to be a mistake because he was a top-notch engineer, but he's not a good manager, and he has no market sense. I kept telling him, you've got to find other markets for this technology, and he just wanted to design a new instrument. He spent all of his time doing that, and the company got into real financial problems. In the meantime, I decided to go off on my own again, and I took a filter instrument that we had partially designed at GAC, and the board of directors said, fine, if you want to go ahead and do something with it, you're going to have it, you know, we're not going to take it anywhere. So that formed the basis of the company that I now have, and we finally ended up selling GAC to OI, which is in Texas, and I'm going to come back to them in a little bit. But they took over GAC and moved the operation to College Station, Texas, and nobody went, and that's one of their problems. None of the key people went. And this is what happens when a big company buys a small company. They think they can move it somewhere and it's going to be intact, but if they don't get the people, they have nothing, you know? They have designs and a product, but they don't have the people who know how to make it cook. So anyway, Don has gone to work for Don Stain at Sensors. And Don, my son, is the guy who's designed the product that is going terrific for them now. It's a microscope FTIR portable that is good at measuring white powder. And boy, that's, you know, as soon as 7-Eleven came, an instrument that will identify a white powder. Is it sugar, salt, or is it anthrax, or is it a drug, you know, or whatever. So they're making these instruments as fast as they can, and it's a $70,000 or $80,000 instrument. And basically it was Don's design, so I'm very glad to see him in a position where he's doing the kind of job he knows how to do. Don went to Harvard, majored in economics, but took spectroscopy on the side, so that was his background. Anyway, that leads us to Wilkes Enterprise, and our business started out you're trying to build a fat analyzer. We want to measure fat in the hamburger and that sort of thing using ATR, and it turned out not to be a good application. The main reason was that if you put hamburger on a plate and try to measure the fat content, you can measure the fat content because it comes out and sticks to the plate, but you can't pick up the protein, and it just was not a good application. But in the meantime, the EPA came along, and we worked with the EPA to try and develop a method of measuring oil and grease and total petroleum hydrocarbon, TPH and TOG. These are the things that you measure in water. And this traditionally had been done using a Myron analyzer and Freon as the solvent. You mix up Freon and water, and it extracts the hydrocarbon, and Freon is transparent in the CH region, so you can stick it in a cuvette and measure the hydrocarbon content. And at Woke Scientific, we developed a portable analyzer that did just this, and it's in use today in all the platforms in the Gulf of Mexico and that sort of thing. So the EPA approached us and said, can't you develop another sampling approach, because we have to do something to replace Freon.
Mm-hmm.
And we eventually came up with a horizontal ATR plate, and the solvent that they used is hexane, which works just as well as Freon to extract hydrocarbons from water. But you have to get rid of the hexane because it absorbs at the same, it's a hydrocarbon, it absorbs at the same wavelength that the oils that you're trying to reach. So by using this horizontal platform and putting a sample of hexane on top of it, letting it evaporate, we could then measure the residual hydrocarbon. And that's the procedure that's gradually taking over today, and we are beginning to sell fair quantities of these instruments to replace the old Wilks-Myron instruments that are out there, and people love them, but they don't make them anymore. Foxborough went out of the business, and they're getting corroded and so forth. So basically, that's one of the applications for this device.
Mm-hmm.
But recently, I have been interested in trying to make inline measurements. Everybody's looking for sensors today, you know, inline sensors of various types. Nobody has a good mid-infrared sensor. And in the mid-infrared, that's where the information is. So I've been working for the last 3 or 4 years and gradually moving toward the ability to put these little plugs in streams. It turns out that one of the big applications is carbon dioxide in water. Infrared is the only known method of measuring dissolved CO2 in situ without going through some kind of a mechanical extraction stage. And that was one of the real reasons that the GAC land systems, land meaning liquid analyzer, was so well received, because the competing technology is either refractive index or density. The problem is that a fluid has only one refractive index or one density, and yet carbon dioxide and sugar both contribute to the refractive index or to the density. So you have to have some other method of separating the two. And they have a pressure temperature method for measuring CO2 or a diaphragm method, and then they correct the refractive index and the density. Infrared has individual absorption bands. You measure absorption band for sugar, and you measure absorption band for CO2 on the same sample. So that was the principle of the GAC instrument, and I've been playing around with applying The GAC instrument requires that you take a sample off the line and pass it through an absorption cell, and then it goes back online. And this is always a problem because of contamination and that sort of thing. And the beer industry won't use that kind of instrument because they don't want to see microbes getting back into the process that can upset the whole situation. So I've been working on actually getting this in line. And it's the old story that new electronic devices become available mostly because of the communications field. You know, there's a tremendous explosion of microelectronics, and you can do things in small packages, and you can use these little chips to do things that it took vacuum tubes when I first started doing business, or transistors later on. But now it's these little microprocessors so we can build today and are going to be building inline infrared sensors. That, to me, that's the future of our business. The filter instruments are going very well. They're portable instruments. You can put them alongside a process, take a sample off and analyze it, that sort of thing. And they're an intermediate step. We take instead of taking an FTIR instrument out of the laboratory out in the plant, you can't really do that because it won't operate in that environment. We can take a filter instrument that'll do the job that the FTIR instrument does. But the real ultimate step is to take it right onto the process mine itself. And I went to a meeting in Atlanta last week at Intabel, the beverage industry. And it turned out that at that meeting there are applications for CO2 analysis that I've known about for a long time, but they're really here today, and there isn't any other way of doing it except by infrared. This sensor is going into breweries, because in breweries there are at least five different places in the beer process where they need to monitor CO2. In the fermentation tank and in what they call the bright product tank, which is the finished beer, but it's created its own CO2, but they have to continually monitor the CO2 level. And when they package beer, they take the high gravity beer, which is 12% alcohol, and they blend it with carbonated water down to 3.2% alcohol, and that's beer. The reason it's 12% is that's as high as you can go in the alcoholic content without killing the microbes. Yeah. Same with wine. You get 12% wine and that sort of thing. But beer is blended down with carbonate, so they need to measure CO2 level in the carbonated water, CO2 level in the beer, and all over. There's nothing that'll do it for them today except take a sample out and do a pressure temperature test on it. But this device is going to do that. There are two other places where it's really going to, if we can get the cost down, all of these dispensers you see in McDonald's or in stopovers on the turnpike, you know, that where you go up and put some ice in them, the biggest problem is monitoring the CO2 level, because if the CO2 level drops, no matter how good the syrup is that they mix with the water, if the soda is flat, people don't like it, you know. So this market sits there. There are literally millions of these dispensers. I talked with the guys at the show, and they said if you can build a CO2 sensor that we can plug right into our line, and you can produce it for under $1,000, you know, you got a market. And I know how to do it. That's what we're going to be moving toward. Another one. And I've known about this for a long time too, is that Coca-Cola has these little white trucks that say quality on them, and they go around and they check the beverage that's being dispensed from a McDonald's or a bar or whatever, and they desperately want a instrument that can stick into a glass of Coca-Cola that's been dispensed and measure the CO2 level. They don't care about the sugar level. They want to be sure that the CO2 level is right. And I talked to a guy yesterday, and they you said, we've been looking all over the world for an instrument. And I said, I know how to do this. You know, in fact, I have a patent on the design. So now I've got to figure out how to raise enough capital to do the design work and that sort of thing. But anyway, out of this show has come two very, very mass market type applications for infrared technology in measuring. Now, we can do other things. We can measure bricks. We can measure another big application that
bricks is the sugar.
Sugar.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it's a, what they call bricks in the. But a big problem in hydraulic systems is water in hydraulic fluid. And we have been able to measure water down to a 100 to 1,000 parts per million level, a tenth of a percent water. And that's getting down in the range where they really want to do it. And this is a technique which it doesn't work optically. But what we need to get down to low concentrations is to have a longer path that we water is a strong absorber. We can't use a long path when we're measuring something in water, but if we're measuring water in a solvent or a fluid, like hydraulic fluid, it doesn't absorb infrared where water absorbs. And I figured out that if we took a saw and just put a saw cut through here, normally the beam goes from this surface to this surface to this surface, and it goes to a detector. But if we put a saw cut in here, we now have a transmission cell. I've expanded the path length, and my son has looked at it and said, it's not going to work that optically, because the rays aren't just going to get from here to here. Well, they do. They get across. One of the reasons is that when you dump this in a fluid, the index of refraction of the fluid is close to the index of refraction of the crystal itself, so that the reflection losses from surface to surface are much less. But anyway, I found that putting that simple saw cut in here gives me about 15 times increase in sensitivity, and we can now measure down in the 100 part per million level of water in hydraulic fluid. Well, it turns out that the European automobile market has been desperately looking for an inline sensor that will measure water in brake fluid, water in transmission fluid. The reason is that a little bit of water in the transmission fluid creates a very corrosive situation, because there are additives in the brake fluid that the water and the additives get together, and they create acid, sulfuric acid or nitric acid. And especially if there are aluminum components in the stream, as there are, they get pitted, and it's a very bad situation. So anyway, here's a market that's sitting out there. We have the technology. Here's the market. How can we put this together and come up with a product cheap enough so that we can hit these two mass markets? One is the beverage industry, and the other is the automotive industry. Well, this is what business is, and this is what I've been doing forever, it seems. But it fascinates me that these applications are solvable, and now we have a relationship with PerkinElmer, and they're willing to develop these microelectronics, and they're really looking for mass markets. They have a Chinese production facility, and their attitude, if you can come up with something with a big enough market, we can really get the cost down, produce it in quantity. And anyway, this is where we're heading as my little company right now. I hope I can stay around long enough to get this off the ground, because to me this is the ultimate in infrared. You know, we start off with laboratory devices that only work in air-conditioned rooms and rock salt prisons and all that sort of thing, and way out here we have these little plugs that we can do the same thing with, and they're totally same technology but totally different approach. And anyway, that's where we are. So I think that's where we've reached my little company at this stage of its development. We have one other project that we're working on now. When Foxborough sold the Myron business to Thermo, Thermo decided to cancel out all of the ancillary products except for the big portable, semi-portable, variable wavelength microprocessed gas analyzer called the Sapphire. It's called the Myron Sapphire, which was developed at Foxborough, and it's a really good instrument. But it's in the $20,000 range, it weighs 50 pounds, and it's not all that portable. And the people who used to sell the Myron dedicated gas analyzers, the smaller ones, have come to us and said, we need these instruments, and they're not being made anymore, and we'll put up the money if you guys will develop, redevelop these instruments. So it's like reinventing the wheel. We're going back into the same market where Brooks Scientific was, but simply because Foxborough or Thermo has decided to abandon that market. And I have a contract with the British Navy to develop replacements for gas analyzers they have that monitor the air quality in submarines. And they can't buy them anymore from Foxborough, so they approached us. And so we're kind of reinventing the wheel. But that's where Brooks Enterprise is today. And we're back in the beverage business, we're back in the ambient air monitoring business, and we're looking at inline sensing and so forth. So that's us.
Are the sensors a continuation of the sort of reflectance technology?
Yes.
And are the gas, these are non-dispersive gas analyzers then, or
the selective wavelength? You know, that's a misnomer. Non-dispersive is used
dispersion
wrong. A non-dispersive instrument was developed by Luft in Germany, and it looks at all wavelengths at all the time, and it compares. You have two cells, one of which is full of what you want to measure, and it absorbs all the wavelengths that you want to measure, and the other is your sample cell, and then you compare the absorbance. That's a non-dispersive instrument, and they were made by Luft and Mind Safely Appliance. What we make are selective wavelength instruments. These are instruments that select a specific wavelength and measure that wavelength. So anyway, yes, these are selective wavelength instruments. They make use of folded path cells to get a long path length. That's that's the gas analyzer. Actually, it's one that we're going to buy from a company in the West Coast that's developed a nice little gas analyzer that has a folded, not, you know, just a gas cell that has folded path in it, and we can put our electronics and detectors and so forth with it. But so, in a sense, we're going back and redoing what we once did, but we're doing it with modern microelectronics and microprocessors and that sort of thing, which didn't exist when we designed the Myron system. Anyway, that's Wilkes up to date. I don't know, I guess I left out some stuff, but anyway, you can ask questions and try to get back.
Should we run out and grab lunch?
Okay.
Yeah. Well, this was another instance of communication between DuPont and myself. I had a telephone call one day from a friend of mine at DuPont who said that they have 32 FTIR instruments by four different manufacturers in their organization, and the different makes couldn't talk to each other, which created problems when they're trying to transmit spectral data and that sort of thing. And this got me thinking, and I got in touch with a friend of mine at JCAMP who was interested in disseminating information of this sort, and they agreed to sponsor a committee to try to get a way to communicate among the various companies, and I was able to get representatives from each of the instrument manufacturers to attend a meeting at PITCON, and we decided that this was something that was needed, and we went to work, and through the efforts of Bob McDonald, who was a retired spectroscopist from General Electric, collectively we developed a program which is still being used today, which is called JCAMP DX, and it is a way that spectra can be digitized and distributed to any FTIR system and disseminated so that all of these different instruments can talk to each other today, and it's apparently it's still in use. So it's on the web, and a lot of the spectra that are available from NIST and some of the other organizations are in JCAMP DX format so that they can be easily transmitted.
Computerized data systems first really get, when did computers really first get conjoined to IRs?
This came about because of the FTIR, the development of FTIR. You need a computer to convert an interferogram to a spectrum, and it really takes a computer program to be able to do that. And once you have a computer, of course you can do lots of other things with it, and that's how the infrared technology became totally computer-oriented. Mm-hmm. Once that occurred, then the various companies that supplied... Once computers became available, then the various companies that that sell spectra put them all on computers and so forth, so that you can easily download spectra today, and it makes it much more convenient to work in the infrared region. And the same is happening in mass spectroscopy also. All of their spectra are available computer-wise. And so.
Well, great. Well, maybe what we could turn now is to some of the questions that I wanted to... and this is going... So going way back again in time to when... to when you first joined PerkinElmer, and you mentioned that John White joined the firm the same day that you did, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about John White and his role in things at
Surely.
PerkinElmer.
John was a spectroscopist at Esso Research in Linden, New Jersey, which is now Exxon, but and he had become very much interested in infrared spectroscopy, and I'm not quite sure how he came about to be hired by Dick Perkin, but he did come from SO and was very happy to make the transition and became a very important part of the company. He developed the so-called white cell, which was the first really long path absorption cell, 20 meter effective path length, and fitted into a Model 21, and you could really look at very low concentrations of gases with that sort of a cell. Among other things, he did the optics for the Model 21 and that sort of thing.
And when you came to PerkinElmer, if I was following correctly, there was sort of the optics group on Long Island what was the size of GET at the time and the different groups?
When I joined PerkinElmer, it had about 60 employees, and they were primarily opticians. Mm-hmm. The big activity of the company was making components for tank sites and that sort of thing. They did have an affiliation with a group on Long Island that was doing optical design of telescopes and so forth. I'm not sure, but they were, I think they were an independent group that was working mostly for PerkinElmer at that time, but then they merged into PerkinElmer. When it moved from Glenbrook, they had a relatively small plant in Glenbrook, Connecticut, to Norwalk, on the Norwalk-Wilton border. Mm-hmm. And that's when the Long Island at a PerkinElmer, and the optical business slacked off at the end of the war, but the instrument activity picked up and became the major activity of the company.
And when you joined, who was heading up the IR effort?
I don't think, let's see, it was mostly a fellow named Dick Kinnaird, who was a mechanical designer and and McCarthy, who was Dick Perkins' brother-in-law.
Hmm.
But they were engineers. They had no marketing affiliation or anything of that sort. And the instrument business kind of grew because all of a sudden Perk and Omer discovered they had a bear by the tail, really. They were getting so many orders for this instrument. And then we learned later that it was due to two programs. It was the synthetic rubber program, where they needed to measure the butadiene ratio, and they could do it beautifully by means of infrared. And the other was the atomic bomb program, where apparently infrared was a very important tool that they were using as part of that program. When the first bomb went off, we were dealing with a purchasing group in New York City that we didn't know who they were, except they had very high priority. Every time they called up and wanted an instrument, they got the next one off the assembly line. And it turned out that they were the purchasing group for the atomic energy project. So that and when the first bomb was dropped or whatever, the purchasing guy called me up and said, "Now you know why, what's happening to your instruments. They were part of this program."
Oh, wow.
And he wanted to thank us for the efforts that we put in and that sort of thing. So that's why infrared got such an impetus right during the war, those two programs.
Mm. And so when did Van Zandt Williams come on board?
He came on about 1949, I would say. It was just, and he came on to supervise the infrared activity of the company.
Mm-hmm. And could you say a little bit more about him as a person and his contribution?
Well, he was an extremely likable person. He had a very pleasant personality. Everybody liked Van. He was not tremendously forceful. I mean, he was not the kind of person that would set goals and say, "We're going to do this, we're going to do that." But he was, from a scientific standpoint, tremendously interested in infrared. And that was his main contribution. He felt that it was a tremendously important technology, and anything that Perk and Omer could do to forward it and make it more widely used was important. And as I told you, he was instrumental in getting the Koblenz Society started, because he felt that there needed to be a strong group that would make sure that the quality of infrared work that was done was of the highest possible quality, which meant having high quality spectra available and instruments that were properly used and that sort of thing. It was possible if you set the controls wrong in a spectrometer like the Model 21, you could get what we call spurious absorption bands. You'd get overshoots, and you would get these bands that you try to interpret as part of a chemical bond and that sort of thing, when they were really an instrumental effect. And Van was very conscious that people should use the instruments properly so they didn't get this false information.
Mm.
And that was one of the things that he was trying to do in organizing the Koblenz group, to kind of watchdog the activities of infrared people.
And so we talked before how there was this unanticipated demand for the IR, for the Model 12, When and how did the idea emerge to start developing a double beam instrument, Model 21?
Well, that came because of the work that was done at Dow Chemical, Norman Wright's group. And when he publicized what they were doing, the instrument companies, all three of them, PerkinElmer, Beckman, and Baird, immediately descended on Dow. And Dow was very free to give out the information. They were not an instrument company. They just wanted to get an improvement in the instrumentation that was available to them to use. So all three companies visited Dow. Baird literally copied the exact model that Dow developed. It was a big, very large instrument with a large rock salt prism and quite cumbersome and that sort of thing. PerkinElmer and Beckman really redesigned existing instruments that they had. Beckman had, I guess, the IR-2 at that time, and PerkinElmer had the Model 12, and the 21 was a redesign of the 12. It had the same basic monochromator, but it had a double beam system, so that it was a double beam instrument rather than a single beam instrument, but the same parabola and that sort of thing. Rock salt prism was used in that instrument that was used in the Model 12. And Beckman's instrument I guess was the IR-4. Now Beckman also had another instrument that was a memory instrument. In other words, you ran a spectrum on a tape, and then when you ran another an analytical spectrum after that, you ran it against the tape, so that it's precisely what is done today with an FTIR instrument. But it was really before its time because it was very difficult to synchronize the tape. This was the IR-3. And Beckman gave it up and went to a straight double beam instrument like the PerkinElmer, which was the IR-4.
And could you talk about what was your role with developing the double beam instrument?
Really very little. At this stage, I had moved into sales and marketing. And I did help put together the first one. Vince Coates and I assembled the first one because I knew how to put optics together, monochrome. I'll tell you a very interesting story about the Model 21. John White came out one day and watched me assembling a Model 12. And it turned out that I was the only one in the company that could make the slip mechanism adjust it so it functioned properly. And he watched me for a while and he said, "You're left-handed." And I said, "I'm left-handed, that's right, and that's why I could do this." He went back to his desk and turned his drawings upside down and reversed the flow in the Model 21. So if you look at the Model 21 today, the monochromator is on the left, and it's accessible from your right hand, whereas the Model 12 monochromator is on the right, and you can access it from the left hand. So that's why the two instruments are reversed. He had started designing them so that they were carbon copy of each other. So,
and who were the other key people as you saw in developing the 21?
Well, I think the basic work was John White and Max Liston. Max has developed the electronic side of it, and he had already developed a high-speed thermocouple that was used in the Model 12, but he did the electronic design, and John White did the optical design and the mechanical layout, and as I said, Vince Coates was the principal designer. He did most of the drawings that were necessary to put the Model 21 together. And then he and I together assembled the first one, and figured out why certain parts didn't fit. That sort of thing, you know, this is always the case with a field instrument. And we kind of worked together on it. And,
well, to stay at this time period, when you're involved in advertising and sales, we spoke earlier that you're visiting mostly chemical process firms. Were you meeting with the analytical chemists in those firms, in their research, or who was it that you were visiting at the firm?
Well, I think at this stage, most chemical companies had instrument groups that we dealt with primarily. They were typically analytical departments or segments of research departments where the basic instruments were kept. And these were the people that we talked with mostly. It wasn't until the lower priced, simpler instruments came along that they really spread out and went to the chemists and that sort of thing. We also, all three companies, participated in infrared schools that were held at MIT and Fisk University and University of Minnesota. These were annual affairs, and the instrument companies brought their equipment and taught people how to use them and that sort of thing. So that was a very major activity at that time.
To what extent, when you were, and this is, we're talking sort of 47, 48 here, into the early 50s, to what extent would you go meet with someone who's going to purchase one of them and kind of tweak the machine for their needs? Or was it really just
a single
sale?
Well, we didn't carry
the
instruments around with us.
Right.
They were too heavy.
Yeah.
We tried to get people to come and visit us, and we did put on schools that would attract prospective spectroscopists, or we supported the university schools, and that's where a lot of the education took place. But it was mostly visiting and discussing applications with people. There was always a choice: should I buy a single beam instrument or a double beam instrument? And you'd kind of find out what was their basic application and that sort of thing, and then you would push them in the direction you thought was best for that particular situation.
Were there in this period from sort of, let's say, well, up until 57 with IR, did you see, were there important sort of lead users or lead sites that you were particularly interested in maintaining their connection to Perkin-Elmer, like DuPont?
Yes, definitely. And the big chemical companies, DuPont and Dow.
Right.
And SO, Shell, of course. Shell was primarily a Beckman company. But the Monsanto, all of the major chemical companies were very prime targets as far as we were concerned. So, as I said, DuPont was to us the leader at that stage. They were really ahead of most of the other companies in their use of infrared. And they had a group that met every once a month and discussed infrared applications and that sort of thing. And we were invited periodically to come and talk to them if we had some new development that they wanted to hear. And we also used them as kind of guinea pigs. If we had something new, we let them try it. If they liked it, we figured the rest of the industry would like it also. So,
I guess over, and I'd like to ask about if the market sort of divides into these sort of camps around in IR, you know, back, you know, Shell, Emeryville, sort of a Beckman lead user site,
DuPont for Perkin-Elmer, a task about just the competition, the different competitors in this period in the IR market, Carey, Baird, and Beckman, and Perkin-Elmer was so successful during this period, if you could talk about.
Well, Baird sort of dropped out of it. They were the first that backed away from infrared, although they were very active in mass spectroscopy or visible spectroscopy. And Beckman, of course, was strong in the ultraviolet region. And I think Perkin-Elmer eventually really dominated the field. They probably had more than 60% of the total market. They were very slow in picking up FTIR. For a long time, they resisted going into the FTIR instrument, so that when they finally arrived, Block and Nicolay had really established a very strong position in Bio-Rad. And I had left Perkin-Elmer at this stage, and I could never understand why they. I think they had were so successful at selling dispersive instruments that they didn't really want to make the effort to switch over and join the rest of the world. They finally did, and I think today they're number two to Nicolay.
So, when we were talking about this sort of technical debate between Perkin-Elmer and Beckman on the focal length, mm-hmm. the F number, why was it, do you think, that Beckman was so committed to these longer focal lengths and Perkin-Elmer was?
Well, it's simply they didn't know how to make aspheric optics.
Okay.
I mean, they did not have the skill in their optical shop. They didn't need it for UV instruments. The UV instruments had plenty of energy, and they could use relatively long focal lengths.
Mm.
And they just didn't have the ability to make an off-axis parabola or an elliptical mirror to focus energy on the detector, that sort of thing.
Okay.
And that's the reason, basically. Perkin-Elmer was an optical company, and Beckman was a laboratory instrument company, and they just had different. They came from different directions.
Mm. One thing that we didn't talk about was sort of talked about the business history dimension of CIC,
mm-hmm.
But we didn't cover that. For Will Scientific, how you put together the funding for that.
Well, that was a very fortunate thing. when I sell a company, I like to sell it for stock, you know, stock for stock deal. And I took Barnes stock for CIC stock, and shortly after I sold to Barnes, Bowling Barnes came up with a tomography, the way of measuring breast cancer by means of temperature. Barnes' skill was remote temperature measurement and that sort of thing, using infrared to measure temperature of transformers and that sort of thing. And Bowling Barnes came up with the idea of being able to spot malignant tumors by the temperature distance. So he developed this thermograph, and it got huge publicity, and the Barnes stock went from 5 to 36 in no time. And I had sold the company, and I took what is called letter stock, which was a stock that was not publicly traded and had not been registered by Barnes for public trading. And at that time I hired a lawyer take me down to the SEC in Washington and plead hardship that I was starting a company and I needed to be able to sell the stock so that I could raise money for the company and that sort of thing. And so we did all the stuff we had to do, and I remember I was visiting Johnson & Johnson in New Jersey when the receptionist called me and said, "You have a telephone call from your home office." And I picked up the phone. It was my secretary, and she said, "You've just received a no-action letter, which means that the SEC will not take any action against you if you sell the stock." In other words, it meant that my stock was free. So the stock that I had traded the company for $5 a share was now worth $36, and I immediately called my broker and said, "I need money." So I sold a big chunk of the Barnes stock. After that, I went back to 12. And but that was one of the fortunate things that happened to me and gave me the finances to develop Book Scientific.
And did you keep that company private throughout?
Yes. Although, as I mentioned, we did have an investment from EG&G,
right,
and then later on from International Nickel. And then ultimately, I sold the whole company to Foxborough.
Right.
Again, that was a stock-for-stock situation, and Foxborough went through a merger situation which pushed their stock up, too. So it turned out to be a fortunate happening for me.
Mm-hmm. And then at Wilk Scientific, I forget the term that I'm supposed to use instead of selective
wavelength. Yeah.
Okay, I'm trying to switch my vocab. Did you make any selective wavelength gas analyzers?
Oh yes,
you did.
Oh yes, they were all based on filter technology.
Okay.
And we used either fixed filters or we used variable filters that we could rotate in front of the slit of the instrument to select a particular wavelength.
Okay.
But they were not spectrometers of the type that used a grating and a prism and that sort of thing.
Right. But some units, I guess maybe I'm not asking it right. Some analyzers you made specifically to look for
a specific wavelength, That's right.
Yeah, characteristic wavelength,
yeah.
And others were more
versatile.
Versatile. There
right.
You go. Okay.
Right.
And those two lines of products were serving. Had different markets then?
Well, not really. If you wanted an instrument to look at a variety of different potential hazardous vapors in the atmosphere, then you wanted an instrument that you could select the wavelength. One time it would be this wavelength, one time it would be another. Often it was a case where you had a specific material and you just wanted a monitor to make sure that that particular material didn't get above a certain level. And that's where you would use a dedicated instrument that had just the right wavelength.
Right. I guess I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about the trajectory of GCIR.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think most people are more familiar with a different sort of, you know, instrumentality to be used as the detector for the or analyzer for the GC. I guess what I'd like to know is about what was the time period when GCIR was really hot or most used, and then what.
Well, I think it's still very hot. I mean,
okay.
But it was developing in the early 70s, almost as soon as GC came on over the horizon. It was apparent that there needed to be a method to characterize these various peaks that came off the chromatograph.
Mm-hmm.
And at GAC, we experimented with different kinds of sampling approaches where we could condense a peak onto an aluminum cup
hmm.
and let let the gas disappear and the peak deposit. Then we would put it in the spectrometer and look at it by reflection. That was one of the first ways we did it. Later on, at Wilkes Scientific, we used ATR as an approach. We built a chamber that you could pass a gas from a chromatograph through. You could turn a valve when the peak appeared, and that particular peak would go through this system, and the plates were cooled by thermoelectric coolers so that we would condense on the surface of the ATR plate the material we're trying to identify, and then we would run a spectrum of that. That was another approach. And finally, we developed light pipes that had the same volume as a typical peak would have coming out of a chromatograph.
Mm-hmm.
And those were actual modifications of the spectrometer itself. We moved the optics back and put the light pipe in between the source optics and the entrance slits, and they became a cell, a long, thin cell, rectangular in shape because the beam in a dispersive instrument is rectangular rather than circular. And they were made by electroforming. You lay down a layer of gold, and then on top of that you lay down nickel, and you get a nice tube that is very highly polished inside and has a gold surface and so forth. So that was that approach is still being used today, the light pipe approach. Although mass spectrometry has sort of taken over because it fits very nicely with GC, and it's probably more GCMS done today than there is GCIR. So,
I wanted to ask you, in the early days of the General Analysis Corporation, I mean, you had a few years before you went into the direction of the beverage. And you said that it was partly a product of Reagan, that it was unsuccessful in the sense of doing the environmental monitoring.
Right.
But did you do some of it? Did you have some clients where you went to their...
No. You know, it just did not take off.
Mm-hmm.
We tried it. We advertised it and did direct mail, and we never really created any clients. It was a total failure as far as... we were concerned, and so we switched over to try to build our own instrument.
How did you find, were there technical difficulties or challenges associated with going from the gas to the liquid?
Well, it's sample handling. That's the real difference. Everything else about the instrumentation is the same.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to measure infrared absorption at a specific wavelength, that sort of thing.
Right.
But the gas cell has to be a long path because molecules are dispersed widely, and liquids have to be a very short path because they're clumped together and they absorb infrared very strongly, so you can't have a long path cell.
Mm-hmm.
That's the advantage of ATR, because you have a very short effective path length with an ATR system, and therefore you're in the right absorption range to look at liquids and solids and that sort of thing. But the same detectors are used, the same filters are used, the same dispersive elements, used. We had an interesting situation at GAC because we had developed a liquid analyzer. And again, I had a telephone call from DuPont, and they invited me down, and they said, we're coming out with a new refrigerant, and it's turned out to be mildly toxic, so we need to have sensors that we can supply, and you guys know something about gas analysis, although GC was not at all in gas analysis at that time. And I looked at our LAM system, which had about a 3-inch crystal in it that was in. I remember I was walking down the 14th fairway at the country club, and it suddenly dawned on me how I could make a gas cell that would have a folded path and would fit into the same space that we had in the, to do a lipid analysis, and we developed this gas cell, which we got a patent on, which is a very simple cylinder with flat ends and gold, all gold-plated inside, and the beam mounted back and forth, and it gives us about almost a meter path and about a 3-inch length. Mm. So we could stick that right in the land system, and I showed that to DuPont, and they said, boy, this is great. That's just what we want to do, except it costs about 3 times as much as we can afford. So we totally redesigned the system and came up with a gas analyzer that was used for refrigerant monitoring. And it was a very successful instrument for a while until we got some competition from MSA.
for that is that you can handle any kind of a sample, whether it's gas, solid, liquid, or a film, or whatever. There's always a sampling mm-hmm. procedure that will let you look at that sample. The other thing is it's non-destructive. It does not. It's not like chromatograph or mass spec. It doesn't do anything to the sample, so it works beautifully on a production line. It doesn't upset the sample you're trying to analyze, that sort of thing. That's one of the big advantages of infrared. And all my career, I think I've been trying to figure out ways of making cells that would hold the kind of sample that people want to analyze, you know, and that's what led to all these different accessories and gas cells and cylindrical cells and things like that.
How big did GAC get between, you know, during the course of the 1980s?
It got up to about 8 million in sales, mm-hmm. and then it began to go downhill.
And about how many employees?
It had about 60 at its peak. As opposed to 120 that we had at Book Scientific, and,
right.
and 10 we have at Books Enterprise. So.
Mm-hmm. And you retired what year? What's the technical official first retirement?
1973, I guess, when I decided that I should turn the company over to somebody else. And,
1993?
93.
Yeah, okay.
So.
Okay. And when you retired in 93, you stayed on the board of directors?
I stayed on the board, and I also began to play around with filter instruments and eventually evolved Wilkes Science, Wilkes Enterprise out of
right.
what we were doing.
Right. But sticking with GAC, what kind of board did it have? How was that constituted? Who was on it?
Well, I had two people who were former IBM people who invested in the company, and they brought a group from Maersk in Denmark mm-hmm. who also invested in GAC, and they were really very excellent outside supporters. I have a high regard for Maersk and their people, and it was just unfortunate that through some management mistakes that I made personally, putting the wrong people in there, that the company went downhill and we had to ultimately end up selling it. So.
Now the retirement was, were there some time of pure retirement before?
About 2 weeks.
Yeah.
About that time I decided I didn't want to hang around the house. And, so I was still involved to a certain extent with GAC, and so mm-hmm. I took some space. I owned the building and I took some space out and back, and that's where I started Books Enterprise. So.
Well, I wanted to ask about with the not so much now the competition between IR manufacturers, but the competition between IR and other types of instruments for for you know the attention of the organic chemist mm-hmm. or whatever. So you know in the 60s, 70s, 80s, the competition, your view of the competition of other types of instruments on IR?
Well, for quite a while there wasn't really a lot of competition. Infrared was really the only viable procedure for identifying molecules. You know, in that period, all of these new molecules are being created, like penicillin, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the chemical structure of these materials? In infrared, by this stage, the absorption bands have been classified so that they could be credited to particular types of chemical bonds. So you could take an unknown material that was created by a chemist and determine its structure. And that was a big activity in the 70s, I would think, as far as infrared is concerned. Then mass spectroscopy came along, and chromatography, which broke mixtures up into components, and NMR, which is a tremendous advance. And these other technologies have begun to not so much supplant infrared, but to join them as quantitative type instrumentation. In recent years, the use of infrared in laboratories has not grown very rapidly. Mm-hmm. It grows maybe 3% a year, although recently I've seen an increase in the use of infrared percentage-wise, if you look at the market statistics. And I don't quite know the reason for this, but other techniques have come along which are very useful. The big expansion in infrared today is moving toward process analysis. And for the reasons that I've given you, it is a material. It has the features of being able to quantify a mixture. In other words, you can look at a mixture and get absorption bands for each component and quantify them. And secondly, it's non-destructive, so that you can stick it into a process stream and without upsetting the stream and that sort of thing. And to me, that's the big movement in instrumentation today is toward process analysis and process control, and a lot of methods are being used, you know, pH and conductivity and that sort of thing. Infrared has not really gotten into direct stream analysis as yet, but it's coming very rapidly, and it's going to be very widely used in the next few years because of the reasons that I've said. Mm. And it's due to increase better materials, better detectors, you know, microelectronics, all these things that have happened that make it more feasible to apply it. Mass spectroscopy is a destructive technique. You can't get a mass spectrum without destroying the sample automatically. You destroy it. The same with chromatography. You destroy the sample. UV is non-destructive. NMR is an important borderline. Raman is something that is really coming in now. For years, it was a technology that nobody really had been able to make wide use of. But with lasers, they give very intense sources. The Raman spectra are much easier to come by today. And I think that's going to be one of the biggest inline technologies in the future. It has tremendous possibilities. It's really an infrared technique, but it's a different way of getting an infrared spectrum, you know. So, but it creates the same kind of a spectrum that you can identify chemical structure and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
And let's see. Yes, I wanted to ask if you could talk about the importance of the evolution of electronics and computing to the development of IR. You know, how important has that, the development of electronics, been to the development of IR technology and then also the development of data handling or digital computing?
Well, it's tremendously important, and it's more important with FTIR type instruments today than it really was with the dispersive instruments, because computer technology is absolutely essential to make an FTIR work, and once you have a computer, then you can do a lot of other things with it. The thing that's made infrared grow, from my standpoint, are things like the space program. Out of the space program came new detectors, which were immediately usable in the infrared, you know, in commercial type infrared and materials. They developed zinc selenide and zinc sulfide crystals, and these were developed as part of the space program or the military programs, and immediately we could apply these materials to infrared sample handling and that sort of thing. And as I've said today, the microelectronics that are appearing are absolutely phenomenal in what they can do in little tiny chips, and that gives you an opportunity to make very small, very useful gadgets out of that make infrared measurements. And it also, the cost is coming down tremendously. I mean, we can sell these things for $2,000 or $3,000 today, and then tomorrow they're going to be $200 or $300, you know, and do the same kind of thing. So, in my experience, has always been that the market grows exponentially as the price comes down. So, as you can drop the price, the market gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So.
Well, that was all the specific questions that I had, but is there a question that we should have asked that we haven't, or do you have anything, any other comments?
Well, I think I've pretty well covered. I guess the only thing I can say is that the opportunities in the field of infrared spectroscopy are just as big today as they ever were. There's a very interesting development that has occurred in the last 5 or 6 years, which I haven't really touched on, and that is the emergence of near-infrared as a technology. It's quite distinct from mid-infrared, and the reason for that is that the absorption bands that you work with are overtone bands. They're not fundamental bands. Every absorption band has overtones at certain frequencies. And in the near infrared, the overtones from the fundamental bands tend to overlap, so you don't get nice, clean, sharp absorption bands. On the other hand, the energy level in the near infrared is like a factor of 10 or so higher. Using tungsten lamps and things like that, you have much higher infrared sources. And water is much more transparent in the near-infrared, so that you can look through water and see things in water that you can't do in the mid-infrared. So there are also materials that are useful, like quartz and glass, which transmit near-infrared and don't transmit. So there's been a tremendous development of the near-infrared field in the last few years. And it's to me, it's almost like a cult. I mean, there's a group that does near-infrared and the group that does mid-infrared, and they don't talk to each other. They really should, because I was invited by a group to join a committee that was trying to develop near-infrared as a qualitative tool. And I said, this is ridiculous. You can't use near-infrared spectra and identify unknown materials and that sort of thing. Stick to the mid-infrared. On the other hand, for a lot of process applications, near-infrared is superior to mid-infrared because you've got better transmission, better materials, and that sort of thing. You got to stick to what it's good. So. And it tickles me because the conference is held every year in New Jersey.
The Eastern Annual.
They keep asking me, why aren't you going to exhibit, Paul? And I said, well, you guys have a paper on mid-infrared, I'll exhibit, but every single thing they do is near-infrared, and they don't have any interest in mid-infrared. So that's what I mean by it's sort of a cultish situation. But if you sit back and look at it, there are very good reasons for using both parts of the spectrum. You have to look at the job you're trying to do with it, and you pick the region where you get the best combination of characteristics. So. I don't know if there's anything else that I have left out.
Well, reflecting back on, I mean, you've had a career that spanned 5 companies, but a very targeted and focused one.
That's right. Yes, and I think probably almost I've been too focused just in this one particular technical region, but I always keep saying to myself, there's so much more to be done here. You know, why should I get involved in mass spec or Raman or whatever, when there's so many things that I know how to do in the mid-infrared, and therefore I should spend my time there and not try to go somewhere else. You know, there are a lot of good people that are doing things in other fields, so that's why I think I stayed focused. And
Well, great.
All right.
Well, I'll switch it off.